So I was going to talk about the dependent origination now, but I'm going to hold it till 2 o'clock. So we'll come back and talk about that. I thought maybe we could reflect a little bit on meditation practice now and see if you have any questions or see if there's anything you want to explore with regard to your practice of meditation. Practice is a lot more than meditation, as I know you know, but the meditation part is important, and it's good to kind of check in on how it's going.
Well, I mentioned in our small group the other day that I'm still reflecting on meditation is a big part of my daily life, and yet I can bring this kind of like warrior, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to go do this kind of attitude, you know, like I really have to like hype myself up for it, and it's all subconscious, and so I'm really like noticing that this week and really using this opportunity to, like you said, build a relationship with my breath when I'm not in meditation. I feel like I'm like taking it out on dates. I'm like, you know, like, how are you, honey? You know, like just really cultivating this gentleness when I'm not in zazen, and I'm just feeling how that's how that's affecting it. So thank you.
Yeah, good. Yeah, there's a lot of that warrior language in the suttas, you know, like strive, you know, I'm going to sit here until my blood dries up and my sinews dry up and, you know, all that. And I've heard they've found monks like this dead in the caves, and it's like, that doesn't sound good to me. It's really important to check on how things feel, how the results of our practice. When someone comes and talks about, you know, doing this practice of watching the breath, and the mind goes away, and you pull it back, and it goes away, and you pull it back, and you pull it back, and they've been doing it for years, and they say they have seen no results. That's, you know, it's really important to look beyond the meditation to see into our life, to see what else is going on. And also, there can be a real stiffness there. And that's not what the mind really responds to, in my experience. Now, we each have different conditioning, and so we want to be sensitive to that. But really, when you look at the description of how meditation progresses, it's letting go of more and more things, and it's really relaxing and becoming more and more tranquil and more peaceful. And oftentimes what's discovered when there hasn't really been, quote-unquote, results is that the sila needs to be, the moral virtue needs to be looked at and needs some shaping up. Sila. Yeah. Yes. Jiao.
Yesterday, I had a question about age and the pet, this thing. And if the enlightenment is progressive, is not just a moment, but is a long journey, how we can shortcut that in order to overcome the lost time? if that's the right terminology. It's second part of my question is, 3 or 4 times you have talked about jhanas.
Mm-hmm.
Is that for a special group?
If
all the meditators, they need to go to this stage, because is that what, because when you look at the literature here, I don't understand a lot, but I see 1 or 2 persons, they come here and say that they have give training jhanas. I came one, I got mm-hmm. the first, I did not got much, I did not understand much of all the process, because it looked like very complex step by step. It's not just the go to momentum. And then it's for everybody to meditate, or is just for a group, yeah. a specific group?
These are good questions, and there are different, in different traditions, the jhanas are thought of differently. So in the suttas, we see this, like I said, stock description of jhana. The characteristics of it. But in some traditions, there's a much more regimented, approach to meditation and how to work with the concentration of the mind. To answer your question, that second question first, in the Thai forest tradition, we have, there's a lot of encouragement for meditation. But we also have master teachers who have been, like Ajahn Gana, his reputation has been that he got enlightened at a very early age. And, the monks who were trained by Ajahn Chah wouldn't come right out and say that, perhaps. And maybe they'll come out and say that after he dies, but they won't probably do it now. But Ajahn Pasano says something like, he had these deep insights at a very early age. And Ajahn Ganha says, people are putting too much attention on concentration meditation. And they're sitting for hours and hours, they get up from their cushion and they're angry about something. It's like they're not really living the way they need. Even if they can attain deep states of concentration, you can't really depend upon that being a sign of actual advancement on the path. So he says, even for monastics, 2 hours a day is enough. But that we need to have sati, samadhi, and panya all day long. So while you're working, and while you're listening to someone, you have your mindfulness, and you have a certain level of calm. Stillness in the mind, that the mind isn't running around all the time, and you're really listening to this person, and you're not trying to think of what you're going to say next. And if we really do that, I've got one person in my life in particular who's very dear to me, but they can talk a long time. And if I just listen and I don't come up with judgments about it, or I don't come up with kind of a lack of patience or whatever, if I just listen, by the time it ends, I feel like I've meditated during that whole time. It's like I'm just listening. And so Ajahn Gunha really encourages the monastics there to do a lot of work, but to really have incredible loving kindness and that presence of mind. So also in the Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Mahabua would say that if your mind tends towards jhana, fine, otherwise just samadhi. And they won't even make distinctions necessarily between samadhi and jhana. So whatever stillness the mind can come to. So there is that kind of attitude that, some people easily go into these really deep states. And I asked Ajahn Gunha, how deep does the samadhi need to be? And he said, not that deep. How deep does it need to be to get enlightened? Was the question. It's not that deep. But again, I wouldn't discount meditation, and we really need to develop the mind and develop that peace and tranquility. But insight can sneak in even when you don't give it that much. So your question of, is that just for some people? It depends a lot on the karma. You know, maybe they've cultivated a long time. Ajahn Brahm apparently just goes into jhana. It's even hard, really, in all honesty, it's hard for him to describe what the rest of us should do because he's so good at it, you know. And so I wouldn't concern myself with steps of jhana or having to get jhana. Bring the whole value and skill of your life in every way up. You know, like really refine our conduct, refine our speech, refine our thinking, and develop that, you know, all those wonderful states of loving kindness and compassion and, you know, appreciation and equanimity and, you know, the factors of enlightenment. We can all make progress with those things. In terms of age, wow, we're all so fortunate to have come in contact with the Dhamma at any age in this lifetime. If you see, which that's what it is really, is to see that there are many lifetimes. If we see that there are many lifetimes, we're not worried about whether we came to this at an older age. However much progress we make, however much we solidify in our mind, I want to be a good person. I don't want to ever kill anything again. I don't want to take anything from anyone. I don't want to, you know, be a problem in any way with any of the precepts. You know, be very determined about that and really change our negative habits and set the course for the future, whether it's, you know, 2 months or 6 years or 2 decades or whatever in this lifetime, it's going to continue unless we're enlightened. So in a way, once we're on the path, we don't have to worry how long it takes to get enlightened, because the happiness and the contentment and the beauty of what we're developing continues, and it brings the fruits all along the way to us.
I'm wondering about your thoughts or your opinion on. I've had some instruction in the past that in meditating, if something really compelling interrupts my anchor, so start with the anchor, but then if a thought or a feeling really shouts, then to turn the meditation to it and feel it, not to storyline it and kind of get carried away in the content of it, but just to feel it in my body and my breath, and then go back to the anchor, rather than what I can do and have done is more like the warrior method is, don't go there, that's an interruption, get back to the anchor. But I'm not sure what your thoughts on that
are. I think it depends. And I think the best thing to do with one's own mind is to try both, you know, and see what the results are. So depending on what comes up, you know, like all kinds of things can come up in meditation. Maybe some memory from the past that you didn't know that even happened, maybe some trauma, or, you know, it could be any kind of thing that could come up. There could be something that comes up that really is an invitation to investigate Dhamma. You know, then it's very likely that investigating that is a skillful way to proceed. hopefully you get a lot of chance to meditate and you get a lot of chance to see the results of how that's going. But I wouldn't let trivial things throw you off.
The compelling was a key word in that.
Yeah. Sometimes things are compelling and trivial. So just knowing that, it depends.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. There are a lot of things that can happen in meditation that if we shift our mind to a more compelling object, that other mess just goes away. So you can think about that too. If there's something that's intruding on your peace of mind, you might be able to just shift to a different object. And the Buddha talks about this in the removal of distracting thoughts. Majjhima Nikaya 20, I think. It's in that 19-20, right? Yes, Lisa.
I love these answers that you're giving. That's answering questions I didn't know I had. And I love that the way you've been talking about the sweetness of the breath and loving the breath. That's been really useful. In our group meeting the other day, I was talking about restlessness. And one thing that you suggested was maybe, especially when I'm moving around during the day, driving different places, maybe taking a moment with a mantra. And now I have a Hindu mantra that was given to me in a yoga teacher training, but I wondered what a Buddhist mantra might be.
The most used one in Thailand is Bhutto. There was a bhikkhuni who went on Tudong, and it was recommended to her to recite with each footstep, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Father, Mother, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. You know, just like what calms your mind and uplifts your mind. And, you know, and I use Bhutto when I do walking meditation with the steps like that, Bhutto, Bhutto. Or you can use it with your breath. If you're sitting, I also talked with you about meditating while driving, and I probably should clarify. It's important to know whether or not you're more alert to everything. You know, like you could be paying attention, knowing whether you're breathing in or breathing out while you're driving. But you want to make sure that that brightens the mind and your awareness of everything that's happening. For example, if the mantra starts to lull you to sleep, that's not a good thing to be doing. Probably any time, except when you want to go to sleep. Adam.
Yeah. Since you're talking about kind of sort of the description of the progression of calming the mind and PT arising and so on, sometimes I have some sort of PT sensation arise and then it'll be strong and then it'll fade away. But then afterwards, there can still be the same sort of intensity, but the feeling is no longer pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I want to leave it or anything. It's just, I'm just curious what that is. Or, I mean, I don't know if anyone can tell me what it is, but it's just, I sort of think of it as like Veda Nupassana, just sort of like observing the feelings coming and going. But it's just, I don't know if I think of the progression in the suttas, I don't know if it's, I can recall something like that in there, or just sort of, I got to a certain point and that's all that I have sort of whatever built up to get to. And
what's the unpleasantness? What's it like?
I don't even know if it's really it's sort of like I'm feeling throughout the body, but it's a little bit achy and not as sort of pleasant as it had been before. It's like the brightness sort of comes up in a wave and then passes sort of.
Mm-hmm. And the body is not left in tranquility.
It's like still fairly tranquil. It's just sort of like, it's not bad, I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So one thing that you can notice is that you might bring more attention to your breath when the PT starts to fade. Mm. You can get to a place where you can kind of dial it up or dial it down, depending on how attentive you are to the breath. Mm. And what we're, you know, what's very lovely is when the PT becomes strong, and then there's that that poem. Did we even do that one? I don't remember. The monk who talks about feeling very light. Mm-hmm. And like he's gonna float away. Yeah, so when body parts start disappearing, that's a good sign. And you know, kind of inviting the PT to spread through the whole body, it sounds like that's happening. So I think what might be needed is a brightening of the mindfulness and attention on your meditation object.
Yeah, that seems right, because I think the PT arises and I just get sucked right into it.
Ah, yes. So have you read the Upakilesa Sutta? I think it's
probably,
it's in the latter part of the Majjhima Nikaya. It's good to look at it again, because the Buddha goes through this whole list of the different ways that we kind of, well, lose it. And you might find it there. And then what's really fascinating about it is when the Buddha identifies, you know, what it was that caused him to, you know, lose the, well, light and form and, you know, what's happening in the meditation, is that he makes up his mind to that that's not going to happen again, or he's like, I made sure that I wasn't going to hold it too tightly or hold it too loosely, or, you know, like this whole list of upakilesas. Kilesa is usually translated as defilement. Ajahn Brahmali says that the commentary uses kilesa, but the early Buddhist texts, the suttas, use upakilesa. And so the upakilesas are kind of like the, I guess, the big defilements or whatever, you know, the defilements. And it's not like some horrible bad thing. It's just that it's some way that kind of throws us off. We get too involved in it, or we aren't involved enough or whatever. But that also what Ajahn Brahmali has identified is that, you know, this, and this is kind of based on what Ajahn Brahm teaches, like we need to like brainwash our mind. Our minds need to be brainwashed by the listening to the Dhamma and hearing it from teachers who are teaching the whole Dhamma and the way that it actually works. And part of that is the, you realize that you can program your mind Like the Buddha talks about this, like when you lie down to sleep, you fix in your mind the time when you want to wake up. And then you wake up at that time. How many of you have had that experience? Yeah. It's pretty amazing, huh? I usually wake up a little bit before I'm supposed to when I do that, and I haven't been affected by some thing that makes it too hard to kind of be present, like, you know, too much caffeine and then not being able to, you know, like something like that. But just kind of the naturalness of the body and mind, it works. And so when you say, one of the upakilesas is fear. The Buddha said so much fear came up. I'm like, terror can come up in the mind. He said it's like you're on the road and there's bandits coming from both sides and you really have this terror that arises. And then he determines that terror is not going to arise again. And you're like, but it's just through suggestion before you start the meditation. Okay, I'm not going to be afraid of whatever happens here. And then the mindfulness is instructed in the proper way and it behaves accordingly. We have two hands that went up at exactly the same time. Allie's going first, I guess.
First, thank you very much for the wonderful guided meditation. And moving from that, anchoring within the sensory base awareness in the body, and then this amplification through the various other ways to use the physical awareness throughout the space in the body is a long practice of mine, and it has given me quite a lot of capacity to walk again. Mm-hmm. Relative to the first day's question, or actually it wasn't a question, it was my question, but you had mentioned neuroscience once. Mm-hmm. And in these more specific aspects of interpreting the whole Dhamma as it starts to flow through my system more clearly, I guess. Mm-hmm. My Western mind and others with whom I'm in contact are suggesting neuroscience as an alternative view or as a complementary view of the what is actually happening. The endocrine system, mm-hmm. all that, parts of the brain. Dan Siegel's work is, you know, the most specific that's out there. And so I'm curious if you have comments, particularly as it related to our meditation practice this morning and some of the questions about when it changes the sensory base, this biophysicality of the deep awareness, and the mind begins to story it or return to some other whatever it might be. What might be some additional ways with the generative grammar of the Dhamma practices, as well as some of these new Western ways of holding, so that as I and we all move toward that future continuation of this, that, it, whatever we want to name it. I'm just looking for just a few crumbs
okay.
or, from the neuroscience.
I'm thinking that, first of all, I mean, I read the Buddha's brain or something, and, you know, I'm not an expert at all in neuroscience. What I would say in general is it's so great to see that the things the Buddha talked about are showing up in scientific research, whether it's quantum physics or it's neuroscience. You know, it's like, wow, yeah, the Buddha was right on. You know, it's like, and And I think that whenever we're thinking about how can these studies and research help us in our practice, it's really the question of, if I delve into this, is it helping me get enlightened? And that largely comes by the way we approach it. So if we pick up pieces of it and it's encouraging us to have more confidence in the process and in the whole kind of framework of Dhamma, of the way things actually are. I mean, science is, you know, what's the point of science? It's trying to understand the way things are. It's kind of limited because there's a, you know, like Dr. Ian Stevenson trying to use scientific method to understand children's memories of their past lives and stuff. You know, there are definitely some limitations. But scientists still keep trying, and that's good. You know, we learn more and more about the reality of our world, and how much can we learn about the reality of the world beyond this. It's hard to know. So I can't help you so much with the comparison or the use of, you know, some part of that knowledge to encourage you, but you might find things that encourage you. And then always ask yourself if this is worth it, if this really helps me wake up. And how do we know? You know? Am I more peaceful? Am I getting out of my head and into experience? Am I more kind? Am I more, able to drop into the depths of meditation? And, you know, sometimes we need to really clear some of the stuff out of our life in order to do this. So those are some things I would use as the guides. I mean, to be very straightforward, when the Buddhist stepmother Mahapajapati came to him and asked for a teaching in brief, this is one of the things you see repeatedly in the sutta, is someone, one of the monastics, will come to the Buddha, give me a teaching in brief that I can take and practice with. And he basically said, you know, whatever leads to peace is in accordance with Dhamma, and whatever leads away from peace is not. So use that as your guide. Yeah, you're welcome.
Two more technical questions, one about meditation and one more general. The first one is, I am interpreting that loving kindness can help bring about sukha. Mm-hmm. Is that interpretation correct, or could you elaborate on the relationship between the two?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my felt sense of piti and metta are pretty close to the same. And, you know, it's good to understand what metta really is, which is this unconditional love, right? Unconditional loving kindness. I think in the Christian sense, when the Christians talk about brotherly love, they might be approaching that also. And so this loving kindness, actually, when I work with each of those divine abidings, loving kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, appreciative joy or altruistic joy, mudita, and equanimity, upekkha, they each have a different feeling. You know, like you go through the standard way of working with them, which is actually in the chanting handout. And when you move from metta to karuna, there you might notice a change in energy, a change in the feeling, and so on. And that metta feeling for me, I mean, sukha is pleasant feeling, you know, and so how we experience that might vary, I imagine, you know, it's like, and the point the Buddha is making about having the piti and the sukha there, which we're going to talk about this afternoon too, because piti is actually one of the seven factors of enlightenment. One of the essential pieces is this incredible joy. Whether it's subtle or it's really strong, you know, we need that in our life, in our practice. And I'm bringing it up today because we're looking at the unbeautiful. This is not to go like down into like, oh, it's all so gray, you know, or whatever, you know. But it's to really see that there's an alternative. When we let go of the sense world, then we have the capacity to experience piti and sukha and metta and so on. And I think it's very similar. So I often, if I'm really busy and there's a lot going on in my mind, maybe quite a few people to think about and how they can be helped or whatever it is, then maybe when I sit down to meditate, my mind isn't really ready for the breath. But it will very easily be ready for loving kindness meditation. And it can take you to the same place. So this, I mentioned metta jhana, people will talk about it that way sometimes. So it really is that it, you know, this piti comes up and the sukha comes up, and then you can move right into samadhi. So yes, I think it's way less important that we have all these distinctions mm-hmm. and the labels than it is to know how to use it mm-hmm. and how to what we feel and whether or not what we're feeling and what we're able to bring forth in our mind, in our body, is helping us move to tranquility and peace and stillness and wisdom. So that was one question.
I think what you just said is a good segue maybe to the second question. And some context is that I feel that understanding for some reason is very helpful for me, I think, in developing confidence. Mm-hmm. And one question that I think boils down to what is attention? Hmm. Or how do you understand attention? I was going to ask for guidance of how to sustain attention. Mm-hmm. But first I'm curious about how to think of it in the first place.
And I'm happy you said that about understanding helping, because the Buddha said that too. And I thought about bringing in the Chanki Sutta and reading part of it to you, and I might do that later, because the Buddha goes through this, like how this really unfolds, and understanding, like you find a teacher who you feel is really teaching the Dhamma properly, and you gain confidence in that person, and then you take in the teachings, and it goes through, you know, like what you do. And part of that is reflecting on the Dhamma, and through reflecting on it and coming to understand it, then we kind of accept it. There's a reflective acceptance of it. It's like, okay, this makes sense to me. So that does help the understanding. And so understanding attention, for me, it's really the the normal, everyday meaning of that word. You know, like if I want my grandson to pay attention, it really helps if I talk about electronic games or whatever. You know, he really pays attention to that. And you know, if I want my granddaughter to pay attention, it's talking about musical theater. And you know, like attention in that very normal sense. You know, when we bring our attention to our breath, we're really there with it. We're present with it. We're aware of, you know, like my granddaughter is like all the different things about, what's his name? Oh, you know the guy. Hamilton guy. Yeah. She can sing the songs. Anyhow, there's attention there and discernment there. And we know what we pay attention to, you know? And now how can we bring that kind of attention to our breath or to our meditation object? We're really interested in it. We really care about it.
Would you say there's something to say about the nature of attention? Or maybe a complementary question is, how do you show that attention is not self?
Attention is not self? I think that we don't own our attention. We don't have to have a selfing around attention at all. Maybe we could create some kind of identity around, I'm really attentive. But I don't think that's a very wise thing to do. Because, boy, that changes all the time, right? So I think keep it simple.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
This is an on and off the cushion question. I've been working with compassion, particularly for those whom I have trouble with. And it's the more I practice with it on the cushion, the easier it is in life. At the same time, as the practice on the cushion has deepened, I sometimes find myself really frightened by the And I know that it's not like I'm using my imagination. Like I sometimes feel myself in the presence of generating compassion for really ill intentions. And I want to practice with that.
Got it.
And it's happening in my family now, where there are people living on both sides of the bombing Palestine.
Yeah.
And so I've really needed that practice in daily life as well.
So it sounds like something's getting kind of mixed here, an aversion and compassion, and I think there's more need for wisdom. So when you notice that, so first of all, we have to understand what compassion is, right? And I'm sure you do, but I want to clarify, because it's so easy to, I mean, one of the near enemies of compassion is to feel like we're above the person in that situation, you know, or to also to kind of have this idea, the word compassion is a little unfortunate as a translation because it means to suffer with. And that's not what's happening with Karuna. There are two words for compassion that are used in Pali. I don't know if you're aware of that. Anukampa and Karuna. And Anukampa is the more usually shows up in the contexts that are more active. When we want to get ordained, we ask that the preceptor out of Anukampa would ordain us. Could you take this compassionate action? Since you are a monastic and you know why I want this, you know, that kind of thing. But to be careful, like, maybe what would be good in this case is to shift away from practicing compassion, because it's got that whenever that underlying aversion comes up, and really move into wisdom, seeing with wisdom the situation that human beings are in, and generalize it, not just stick with the person or the group that you're reflecting on, but really see it throughout time, see it throughout the world. Because the suffering of human beings is so pervasive, and the wrong view that human beings have, and the lack of understanding of karma that would cause them to kill ever, to break any precept. You know, this is a really sad condition. And we have some of it in ourselves. We're not enlightened yet. So I think I would shift away from that idea of I'm going to use compassion to deal with my aversion, and see if you can deal with it more with wisdom first. And then when the compassion arises or the loving kindness arises, naturally, fine. But don't let it come from an unwholesome root. It's really, really wonderful that you're seeing these layers. It's really good practice. And to have that compassion for yourself. It's okay that this is happening. It's wonderful that you're seeing it. And it's beneficial to see that there are different ways to approach. I mean, your intention is you want to have a wholesome feeling and attitude towards this very unwholesome situation. Yes, exactly. And this unwholesome situation is not going to go away, because it keeps repeating. And we need to see it in its context. And this is why we want to practice and purify our own minds. Yeah. Oh, Molly's next.
Well, you gave me a cue, so I can't miss it, because this is the room where it happens.
Oh no, musical theater. Big distraction sign is coming over. So I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
What is it that settles your mind?
Openness to not to. It's an experience. Mm.
Mm-hmm. So this acknowledgement or felt sense of oneness.
Yes.
Is that it?
I thank you for this question. This is such an exquisite way to round the circle of the experience here. It is a felt sense which is very available to me when I remember of being not self.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you. Next.
In response to what was just shared in the sense of worldly suffering and the practice of compassion and turning to wisdom, sometimes, and I guess with the intent, because while you were speaking, I kept thinking like, well, intention and cycles of how suffering begins and ends and how our wholesomeness can be interrupted when we're in that cycle of trying to figure out how to make something of others' very strict views or like it, I guess sometimes there's a sense of, for me, like guilt with seeing the wider view and almost that sense of unconditional love and compassion of meeting others where they are, seeing, sensing, feeling, knowing the tools. Like I think of it as like a toolbox that can be used to try to share wholesomeness or continue to identify wholesomeness within myself, and that sometimes, which I think is something I'm really focusing on this week, like coming back to that brightness, that virtue, that practice of it not being such a guilt and maybe almost lacking or depressive feeling to just shift away. And maybe that's physical, maybe it's just energetically, emotionally. And that sometimes the cycles just have to be like let be, and that the wholesome, unsure if this is making sense, but
let me see if I can.
Like it can at times feel, and again, this might be what I'm working on, like the intention is not self-related or selfish, mm-hmm. but sometimes when there's a recognition that the cycles will just continue and you can see others where they are within it and perhaps really taken by it or, you know, not in a different wave of what they perceive as wholesomeness. And you have offered all you can, whether, you know, not even in the sense of what is asked or without being asked, like just of being. And that sometimes you have to just redirect to come back to your own wholesomeness.
Yeah, we have to come back to ourselves again and again and see the wholesome and the unwholesome there.
Yeah, and I guess that's where the conditionings of the world in which we live, because it's very against that, like to not maybe ruminate or to find the solution or to, you know, to really just like this practice of letting go and like encompassing a wisdom of trust and virtue and how that might, how it will, which I then think is attention and confidence, like many different things that have been said already, how it will impact the workings of our universe.
Where's the guilt in this? You mentioned it. Where does that come from? I mean, I know that our culture, enculturation, mm-hmm. is heavy on it. Whether yeah. we started in a kind of guilt-laden religion or not, it's mm-hmm. in our culture.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think about when you're in the small group and you ask me, like, well, what do you think of your virtue? And I think it can come from, like, needing to strengthen the trust and confidence in that and allowing that wider perspective.
I think that part comes from strengthening the virtue. Mm. So if you really want to strengthen virtue, it's good to take the 5 precepts every morning and determine to keep them. And then the strength and confidence will grow. And the harmlessness and seeing that you're not harming others. And then, you know, it's a natural blossoming from there of peace of mind, happiness. We still might be assailed by guilt because of the patterning, the conditioning, the habit. But then in that case, you know, it's like, well, I don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And you can begin to let go of that in the past. And then, you know, it's like we do this work in ourselves, and then we have much more clarity around what's happening with others and what's happening in the world. And we have a lot more clarity about how to help. And we only help upon, you know, let me see if that's true. Mostly, almost always, we only help when invited. When we want to initiate giving help, and we ask if it's okay. Right? Because, you know, it's respectful. And not to get drawn down into, like you said, those negative, unwholesome, depressive, dark states. But the more we develop our virtue and our generosity, which can be expressed in all kinds of ways, in every moment there's an opportunity to be generous. With our thoughts, with our well wishes, with our words, with our actions. And then by doing that, by cultivating that, that's where that inner stability and straightness comes from. I like that poem we had at the end last night where the Buddha talked about that monk. How did he say it? This monk is straight. Something like that. Probably right here at the end. Having a mind utterly straight. You know, it's just so beautiful. And then the wisdom develops of how to show up in the world and what you want to do with your life. And, you know, like, you don't waste time anymore. Well, you don't run into dead ends and regrets. First Carol, and then Joyce.
When I meditate, my mind is...
Can you talk more into the microphone, because I can't hear
you. Okay. When I meditate, my mind slows down. and it's there's very few thoughts. And when you mentioned about PT, I've never ever felt joy or bliss or rapture, any of the words people use to describe it. I get the tingling. I get tingling throughout my body.
Well, that's it. That's PT.
But it's not rapture. It's not
joy. I know. These English words are just so inadequate.
It's not this overwhelming feeling of bliss. With the tingling, I will get hot.
Yeah.
I get very hot.
Yeah, I understand.
Sometimes I will sweat.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody once told me that that is because it has to do with past lives. It's burning up past deeds.
They don't know what they're talking about.
Okay. Thank you. Because that's what I'm wondering. Because I'm not... I don't have...
Don't worry about that.
Thank you. Because there's no thing in my head of the hindrances. There's no greed.
Yeah, yeah. Just throw that away, Carol.
Okay. So what is the heat from?
It's just, I don't know.
Okay.
I used to have it a lot at Amaravati. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful practicing in a place like that. This is a big monastery in England, started by Ajahn Sumedho, under Ajahn Chah. There's a lot of monks and a lot of nuns and a lot of lay people. And yeah, for, I don't know, I think it might have been a wintery, no, it was a, I don't know, some retreat there that I'd lived there for a couple of years. This heat would just flush through my body along with the PT. Yeah, it's just a thing, don't worry.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I was wondering because...
No worries.
It happens quite easily.
Yeah, it's a great... That's
the
because
tingling.
You've been conditioning
okay.
the process and yeah. So... Keep going.
Well, I thought the tingling was my hands falling asleep and my feet falling asleep.
You know, but it's different, isn't it?
It is.
When your hands, when something falls asleep, it's a different thing.
Yes.
But it is kind of similar sometimes.
Okay.
Thank you. And then letting that go through the whole body. Ajahn Bhikkhu said, every pore, every hair follicle. And then when your mind gets more and more quiet. And the thoughts disappear. That's a good sign. And that's good. When the body parts disappear, that's a good sign. Yeah.
Well, this is such a broad question that it's a quick question because it's probably a question for a whole other week course. But there's been there's so much of mindfulness of the body, whether it's the breath or the sound. Do you have a reference or a place to go to learn more about the mindfulness, the other mindfulness?
Yeah, so the what I took us through this morning in the guided meditation was really the whole, in a sense, the whole 16 steps of Anapanasati, mindfulness of in and out breathing. And it's only the first four that are really focused on the body. So the Anapanasati Sutta, the Anapanasati formula that shows up in a number of suttas, was the meditation approach that the Buddha used himself, and he really highly recommended it. He said that it's sufficient to fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness. So you've got those first four instructions are about mindfulness of the body, and the next four where you start to feel PT and sukha, and you're already in there working with the activity of the mind and calming the mind. That's the feeling section. And then when you're looking at mental states, and you start to like, what is the state of the citta? So it's interesting because in the previous set, there's the citta sankhara. You're supposed to like observe the citta sankhara and then calm it. That's the activity of the mind. And then you start to observe the citta itself. And one reflection is, what's the difference? You know, what is that? But then the examples that you see, like in the Satipatthana Sutta also, you know, you're looking at the state of the mind. And then, you know, the Buddha goes into gladdening the mind in the Anapanasati Sutta. And it's like, okay, what do you do if you have these various hindrances in the mind? You lift the mind up, you bring it into more happiness, more joy. You know, and a lot of times that's done through reflections on the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. There's actually a collection of 6 recollections that the Buddha recommended, and I kind of referenced all 6 of them this morning. It's like, it's the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. You're really tuned into the qualities of the Buddha, the qualities of the Dhamma, qualities of the Sangha. And then there's the reflection on your own generosity. And there's the reflection on your own virtue. And then the reflection or recollection of the devas. And when the Buddha describes that recollection, it's really thinking that, well, those beings became devas because of their beautiful qualities. You know, because of their virtue and generosity and their knowledge and their faith. And I have that. I have that generosity. I have that virtue. I have that faith. I have that knowledge. I have, you know, and then that lifts up the heart. And then you go into samadhi, ideally. And then you come out of samadhi. And then you work with the last 4 instructions, which are the Dhamma. It's a Dhamma section of mindfulness. So the suttas and the Buddhist teachings are filled with how to develop those areas. And you're right, that's a wonderful exploration. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, oh, Molly wants to say something more.
I promise not to sing.
I'm sorry, what?
I promise not to sing.
Oh. Okay.
There are 2 sharings, I think, here that I hope would be useful. One is Naomi Remen's difference, making a difference between helping and serving. Mm. That helping is something you do to someone, yeah. And serving is something that you ask. You are there,
and compassion is
that's the
wishing for the suffering to end. But you're not looking down. You're not reaching down. You know, it's not helping. It's serving.
Yes, and linked with that is a workshop, a training I did here, or a seminar I did here, which was looking neurobiologically, mm-hmm. at the difference, and this was having to do with burnout, mm-hmm. between empathy and compassion, and mm-hmm. that in fMRIs that you actually can see neurologically that empathy is when you go so much into the other experience that you experience it in mirror neurons with their bodies.
Back and to that compassion, that suffering with.
That's right, suffering, yeah. With. That's, yes, that was a very good definition in English. And that compassion is just, your language was exquisite for that, which was opening it to a very wide, right into the net of Indra, into the wide experience in which everything is included, yourself included.
Yes.
And that neurologically is very different, mm-hmm. than yeah. just empathy. And I think for those of us that are working in the field of service, that's very, very useful. And it really, you know, puts a highlight on working with the essence of compassion and helping people train that rather than going directly into someone else's experience. You can weep with them, but you can also burn with them.
Yes. Yes, it's very important to know what compassion actually is, as you say. And it's a Brahmavihara. It means it's a heavenly, divine state. A divine state does not have a pulling down sadness. I'm wallowing around in it with everybody else. That's not what it is. It's a divine abiding. And it's a caring about the suffering that people are experiencing, but you're not down in it with them. And you can do a whole lot more good from that place. And it also keeps things in balance. So this burnout is because we're giving so much of ourselves. It's like we're taking it from ourselves and giving it to others, and that's not the best way to do healing work. The best way to do healing work is have the energy come through us.
So the goodness happens.
And if it's really going well, you're energized at the same time. Right? So this is the nature of the Brahmaviharas. You're uplifted, even though you're recognizing the suffering. And you have that kindness, that compassion, that wish for the suffering to end, and you most likely will do things that will help that suffering end.
It has to do with trust and confidence, doesn't it?
I would say the confidence in the Dhamma, the confidence in the path, the confidence in our own development in the path. It all really works together. And the other Brahmaviharas are all involved. And the Brahmaviharas each of them have their distinct purposes. You know, like metta is good most of the time. Have that loving kindness there. But in particular, when things are going well. Compassion is for when there is suffering and you care about that. You have that kindness there with it. I don't know, that's kind of mixing it up. No, you know what I mean, like compassion. It's hard because I don't have a good English word that really covers it. And then the joy, the mudita, is for when people are doing wholesome things. There are good qualities, and we can almost always find something good in whatever situation there is, and wherever there's good, that's what we can rejoice in. So instead of having conflicts with people that don't agree with you, you can look at for what they're doing that's good. What are they doing that's virtuous? What are they doing that is in accordance with Dhamma? And put your attention on that. What we put our attention on grows. So, you know, in the texts oftentimes, or in teaching about mudita, they'll talk about this is the counter to jealousy. Instead of being jealous about this person getting the job you wanted to get, you bring up joy. But that almost starts to sound like this same kind of business of I'm just counteracting some negative mental state in myself. Whereas if we practice rejoicing when we see goodness, then we've got that handy and available whenever, you know, we have those twinges of unwholesome feeling. And then equanimity is really beneficial when people are doing bad things. So this is another thing to look at when you're looking at these situations in the world where people are doing such incredibly unwholesome things. Is to really bring up equanimity. You know, everybody has to deal with their own karma. And you know that they're making kama that's going to bring some difficulties for them in the future. And it's sad, but it keeps happening, and there's nothing we can do to really put an end to all greed, hatred, and delusion in this world. So it's important to really develop equanimity. And a lot of that is, as Molly was pointing out, that kind of broadening of our perspective, being able to see it in context.
I do have a question, but I can hold it for this afternoon if you wish. Are we going to have another session this afternoon?
We are, but why don't you ask it? And if it's too big, maybe we'll...
Okay. And I'm asking it with Allie also, which is about language and the sound of language and the language that... These were very heavy days we had the last 2 days. Charnel grounds, all the defilements and the rotting, pus-filled yuckiness of it. And I, the question has to do, actually, and I'm going to have to set a context for it, because as a musician, I listen to sound as music. So I think about the frequency fields and how vowel, I'm not thinking about it, but experience vowels and consonants and cadence and the movement of sound and words as music, which is a language beyond the content. And a lot of the English descriptions of what is being conveyed through those suttas is so harsh and I felt almost assaulted, and not insulted, but assaulted by these conceptions, and kept pushed off the path because of the, I'd say garbage, but then I want to compost it. because of the tin can, follow through that comes the meanings that we carry, that they carry in our life. Anyway, in Pali, in these original words, you've said again and again that it's really useful to listen to these dialogues or listen to these teachings. And I wonder if there's any sort of calibration that you have. The Pali is very beautiful. And I wonder if that music carries, here it is. Does that music carry meanings past content?
Mm-hmm.
That we
it
might...
also carries energies past content.
Who?
Energies.
Oh, that's exactly it. It's about energy frequencies. It's about frequency calibration.
Really. Sanskrit and Pali, as I mentioned, evolved in a spiritual context. And they're used for, maintaining and passing down scripture. And there is something in the sound. Maybe it's largely because of chanting these same words in that spiritual context for so many millennia. Mm-hmm. But there definitely is something there. And when we chant blessings, there's definitely something that gets carried down from long time and from the Buddha. And so I think there's something to that. And I also want to say that the Buddha wasn't always gentle in his speech. Mm. And neither are the forest masters. It can be pretty blunt and stark and graphic and challenging. And we have to learn to know how to hear it without feeling wounded by it. Because it's not coming from a place of harshness. It's not coming from a place of meanness. It's not coming from any... It's a desire to wake us up and have us see what's really going on. And if you keep it too fluffy and light, it doesn't always do the job. So,
what's, you know, the word for peace?
Peace?
In Pali.
There are a few different ones. Pasadi is pretty nice.
Pasadi.
Yeah. Think about it, yeah.
When I hear peace of mind, sometimes, you know, my humorous poet mind hears peace of mind. It's the peace that's just a little part of our mind that's now being activated
now, here. Now, Molly, you got to ask if that helps you any.
Yes.
You know, like, is what is going to help you get enlightened? Drop everything else. That's a good place to stop. Okay.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.